Tom Hall. This is Midday. Every year, Facebook, which is now called Meta, has produced unparalleled profits and problems. Today on this archive edition of Midday, how should the company be held accountable for the misinformation and hate mongering on its site that has poisoned the well of public discourse around the world? I'll speak with New York Times reporters Cecilia Kong and Shira Frankel about their best-selling book that chronicles the social media behemoth's dominance and controversial positions between the last two presidential elections. Asserting that it is committed to free expression, how should the company be regulated and by whom? The book is called An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. I'll talk about it with Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kong after the news. Welcome to an archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Nearly 70% of Americans have a Facebook account, and Facebook's unrelenting mission is to add even more people to that huge list of subscribers and to keep all of us glued to those accounts for as long as possible every day. Executing that mission has made Facebook insanely profitable. The company is also unquestionably problematic and unapologetically purposeful in its manipulation and marketing of our personal data, most of which we disclose quite freely. The Federal Trade Commission has updated its antitrust lawsuit against the tech giant, arguing that it should be broken up into smaller companies, separating, for example, Facebook from Instagram and WhatsApp. My guests today are two award-winning reporters from the New York Times, Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kong. In a disquieting book published in June, they examined Facebook in the period between 2016 and the 2020 elections. 44% of Americans say they got their information about candidates from the behemoth social network. And a lot of the time, that information is spurious, generated by foreign states like Russia, and sometimes the candidates themselves. The deleterious effect on basic democratic institutions is immeasurable. And as Kong and Frankel document, Facebook's efforts to curb it are ineffective and contrary to Facebook's business model. Facebook's reach into the global community is unmatched, and its unchecked power presents a conundrum to those who would break it up or attempt to regulate it. The book is called An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. In recent months, a whistleblower named Francis Haugen testified before Congress and released internal documents that show how the harmful effects of Instagram on young girls were known to the company and other damning revelations. Today's show was recorded before that testimony and before the company announced that it was creating a new umbrella company called Meta. Cecilia Kong joined me on Zoom. Shira Frankel joined us on our digital line. Because our conversation was recorded earlier, we're not able to take calls and comments today. So Cecilia, if I could, let me start with you. The first thing that struck me when I read this really terrific expose, I suppose one would call it, is that Mark Zuckerberg really is central to all of the decisions, the big decisions made at Facebook. There is a huge senior leadership team. They have tens of thousands of employees. But it all comes down to what Zuckerberg thinks should happen and what the direction that Zuckerberg wants to take the company. You write that in 2018, he says to his fellow senior management folks that he wanted to become a wartime leader. So he's clearly feeling the heat for a number of different ways. What did he mean in 2018 when he talked about becoming a wartime leader?
Yeah, Tom, first of all, thanks so much for the great introduction. And we were surprised by just how much this company is the reflection of and the embodiment of its co-founder, Mark Zuckerberg. He absolutely is in control. We knew that, of course, that he was in control because he has a majority stake, equity stake in the company. But we were surprised in reporting this book by just how much he was dictating and making the final call on very important decisions. In 2018, he had this meeting at Facebook's headquarters, where he declared that he was no longer going to be a peacetime leader because Facebook was facing so many problems and so many challenges and a lot of public criticism over election interference on the platform in the 2016 election, as well as a massive data privacy scandal known as Cambridge Analytica, where data was used on users for political manipulation or political voting targeting. And Zuckerberg, in that speech, which we called the wartime leader speech, said to his dozens of lieutenants, he declared that this was a wartime. This was a new, very difficult period for Facebook. And it wasn't that he could no longer essentially let all of his deputies run the way that they had been running, where he delegated a lot of the things that he frankly just did not find interesting to other people. But instead, he would seize greater control over big policy decisions, specifically and particularly related to content and speech and how politicians what they could post and what they couldn't post on the site. So in this meeting in 2018, he told dozens of people in this room at Facebook's headquarters, dozens of other executives, that in hard times, essentially, that requires a different kind of CEO. He was no longer going to be a peacetime CEO, but he would be a wartime CEO, which required not only more from him, but a completely different shift in focus and attitude among the company. And that really was a pivotal moment that we wanted to show in this book, where Mark Zuckerberg went from always being the head of the company, but in fact, taking over so much more control than he ever had before, over even some of the most, not just mundane decisions, but just more decisions generally, but on the most consequential decisions that he frankly did not have a lot of experience in as well.
And Shira Frankel, Zuckerberg's fallback position is always one of being an advocate for free expression. I wonder if you could walk us through the incident that I'm sure many of our listeners will remember, where there was a video posted on Facebook of Nancy Pelosi in which she appeared to be drunk, and the video was manipulated to make Speaker Pelosi seem like she was inebriated. And there was a lot of pressure for Facebook to take that video down. How did that finally end up? And what do you think that particular incident tells us about, you know, the way Facebook is run and Zuckerberg's approach to these things in general?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We chose to report on that specific moment in the book because we think it's so memorable to so many people. We had the Speaker of the House and many prominent Democrats publicly lambasting Facebook over that decision and saying, how could you allow a manipulated video to remain on the platform even when evidence is showing that people are being misled by it? People think this is, as you said, a real video of Nancy Pelosi appearing inebriated and slurring her words. In fact, it's manipulated. It's been slowed down and tweaked with so that she appears to be inebriated when in fact she was just, you know, speaking in the way she always does. In that decision, Mark Zuckerberg in a way showed he is the person he always has been. And he, from his earliest days of founding Facebook, this is a man in his early 20s, straight out of college, is drawn to this libertarian idea of a free speech, of, you know, let's not regulate things too much, let's not tamper with things too much, let's not moderate things too much. And that essentially the fewer decisions Facebook had to make and the less involvement I think Facebook had to make, the better it was for them as a business. And so years later, when he is faced with this decision, despite people, including, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, telling him we should take down this video, this sets a bad precedent, and we're going to face political backlash in Washington for allowing this video to remain, and we're just sort of setting up a policy we don't totally understand, he makes the decision to leave the video up. And he does so in a way which is quite interesting. He says, well, if this was manipulated using AI, or if it was deep fake technology, essentially more advanced technology that entirely fakes a video, then Facebook would remove it. But because it was just sort of slightly tampered with and augmented in the way that, well, Facebook's PR people say, in the way that Saturday Night Live or another show might tamper with video, they're going to allow it to remain. Now, of course, this sets up something that Facebook's PR people can't really defend, which is when reporters call to ask about this, they say, well, you know, Saturday Night Live is labeled, and other shows, when they do something for comedic effect, when a skit is done, it's labeled as such. This is not labeled. And so Facebook's PR people kind of stumble over this. They're not quite sure how to defend it. And to this day, we don't really have a very clear policy from Facebook on what type of manipulated video they're going to remove and what they're going to take down.
That's Shira Frankel, along with her colleague at the New York Times, Cecilia Kang. They've written an incredible book called An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. And Cecilia, in terms of Zuckerberg's transparency, let's begin with the employees themselves at Facebook, because he does hold these regular, what he calls town hall meetings, and he invites employees of the company to submit questions that he will then answer and discuss. I guess he chooses the ones he, you know, decides to address. But employees had voice concern, for example, about the role of Facebook in electing Mr. Trump in 2016. Early on in Facebook's evolution, Zuckerberg decided to reject a $1 billion offer to buy the company from Yahoo. And there were a bunch of employees, that was back in 2006, a bunch of employees supported that deal, and they wanted to know why Zuckerberg had turned it down. But how would you assess, you know, Zuckerberg's level of transparency with his employees and then also with the public at large?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, people need to understand just how big the public relations apparatus is of the company to understand how it controls its image and how that's so important to Facebook. Really, the future success and the continued success of Facebook depends on how people perceive the company. So Mark Zuckerberg does take effort to allow employees to address him even directly in these Q&As that are held regularly, where employees, and as you said, actually, Tom, it's actually the PR staff that chooses what questions actually get asked. But there is a level of transparency there, at least ostensibly, absolutely. And there's a level of transparency in that Mark Zuckerberg does hold some interviews, and sometimes he does have video conferences. He has held some of these Q&As with employees. He's released them publicly as well. But ultimately, what we found is even when employees do protest decisions, he says he listens. But the pattern has been that he goes with his own decisions that are often counter to what employees are asking for, regardless. So in the example, and I'm glad you brought up the incident of Yahoo bidding for Facebook for $1 billion in 2006, and that was an unheard of price tag. All top managers at that time wanted Zuckerberg to accept the bid. And when he did not, they walked out. Mark Zuckerberg said later, they quit. And Mark Zuckerberg said later, that was one of the toughest times for me. Everybody was against me, essentially. But what happened, and we think that it was a very emboldening episode for him, because in the end, he believes he was right. Facebook became an independent success. At the time, people said, you're crazy to turn down the deal. Facebook will never get that kind of evaluation. Right now, the company's valued at $1 trillion. That's, you know, compared to the $1 billion bid. So there's a series of things that Zuckerberg has done that has actually emboldened and has strengthened his resolve in himself. He trusts his gut and he trusts himself incredibly. And so there is some transparency within the company with employees. There is some transparency with the public. But that kind of transparency with the public very much adheres to specific talking points in an image that Facebook wants to control that is many times not reflective of what's really going on. And Tom, that's why we wrote the book, to take people inside to tell what the real story is. And as far as with the employees, where the employees go, he tells the employees that he wants to hear them, but the pattern shows that he does not actually act on what their requests are.
You're listening to an archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guests are Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kong. We're talking about their book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the role that Sheryl Sandberg plays in the company. She is Mark Zuckerberg's right-hand person who is often charged with the job of telling the company's story to the public and to lawmakers. Our program was recorded earlier, so we can't take any new calls or comments today. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today in this archive edition of Midday, we're talking about the social network giant Facebook. The company and its founder, Mark Zuckerberg, have been the subject of many books, documentaries, and narrative films. Today, we're listening to a conversation with the authors of one of the latest entries into this crowded opus. Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kong are reporters with the New York Times. Their book is an assiduously reported and damning exploration of Facebook's actions between the last two American presidential elections. It's called An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Our conversation was recorded in September before a whistleblower named Francis Haugen testified before Congress and released a ream of damning internal documents. Just last month, a new report blasted the company for spreading misinformation about COVID-19. And since this book was released, Facebook has even changed its corporate name to reflect its entry into new areas. The new company is called Meta. Shira Frankel, let's talk about Sheryl Sandberg and her relationship with Mark Zuckerberg. She's a very high-profile corporate executive, one of the highest-ranking women in corporate America, certainly one of the highest-ranking women in tech. She's the author of that book, Lean In, about executive action and executive posturing, etc. What's their relationship like now, and how has that relationship evolved over the years that they've worked together at Facebook?
Well, it's interesting for us as reporters to see how it's changed, because publicly, Facebook always presents the two of them as being in lockstep with one another. Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg even appeared physically in lockstep the day that our first excerpt from our book was published. However, multiple executives of this company have told us that there is now a bit of a disconnect between the two of us. And I think one executive really put it best when he said there used to just be Mark and Sheryl and the two of them at the very top of the company. But where there was just, when there were just two, now there are many. You have a number of executives that have risen through the ranks that weigh in on things that Sheryl Sandberg used to weigh in on, including people like Nick Clegg, now the global head of policy. And when you look at the type of events he does and the kind of public speaking engagements that he is involved in, those are very much things that Sheryl Sandberg used to do. And so you're seeing, as the company has gotten bigger, a number of people step in and assume roles once taken by her. You also see her in our book, sort of her ideas around things and her opinion on things repeatedly dismissed by Mark Zuckerberg as he decides to do what he thinks is best. And it shows, as people close to Mark said repeatedly to us, it shows a trajectory in which he himself has assumed more and more power, and he has consolidated control over many parts of Facebook underneath himself and has decided to be the sole decision maker on many things that he once relegated to other people. And that has also affected their relationship and her importance at the company.
And Cecilia, what is different about Facebook from the other tech giants? At one point you write that Google, for example, filled the demand, but Facebook created it. Talk about what the difference and distinction is there, and also the fact that Facebook is organized around closed networks, whereas, for example, something like Twitter is a public forum. Why does that make a difference, and how is it different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first difference that you're referring to, Tom, has to do with the business model difference between Google and Facebook. And it's a really interesting distinction that has big ramifications. So Google basically tracks all your searches to see what you might be interested in. And then it runs an auction behind the scenes and makes sure that whoever wants to sell you things is able to see that you just search for airline ticket to Bermuda and you may need, therefore, swim trunks, you may need a hotel room, et cetera. So behind the scenes, a lot of brands and advertisers then bid to put their brand in front of you in the form of an advertisement. And those are so, and that kind of targeting of advertising is very direct and at a point in the psychology of the person who's running that search, who's putting that search query in the Google search bar, where they may be in the mood to shop. And so you're getting you what's known as at the bottom of the filter, which is a marketing term, the bottom of the filter, because you're so close to the spout, you're just about to buy. And so Google's able to direct these advertisers to you to potentially fill that demand. They know what you might be interested in because you already searched for Bermuda and you probably need a swim shorts and you probably need a hotel room in Bermuda. What Facebook did, which was different, and that has big implications because of the amount of data required to do this well, is Facebook takes essentially the identity of each of its users, and each of its users divulge so much about themselves. And they also, very importantly, reveal who they truly are. They know that Cecilia Kang truly is Cecilia Kang, who lives in the Washington, D.C. area, and she may have a history of X, Y, and Z sort of interests related to politics, related to, what her political persuasion may be, who she's friends with, what her age is, what she's talked about before on the site, what kinds of stories she shared that show that she may be somebody who likes to buy luxury goods or not, or maybe somebody who likes deals. All this kind of information they're able to give to advertisers so that advertisers can then buy that information, that very specific targeted information about each of these individuals to target ads that and to try to get people to even just get interested in the broadest sense in their product. It's actually not so dissimilar, Tom, to what TV has done forever. When Coke advertises on the Super Bowl, they're just trying to get their brand in front of people. What Facebook is doing as well is doing that, is trying to get the brands in front of people's eyes and get them even thinking about the brand and potentially turning them into loyal customers of those brands. But what they offer advertisers is a little bit of a jump start so that advertisers can reach the people who they normally wouldn't ta target, be able to reach in these other mediums like TV and newspaper. And it's very powerful for the advertisers to be able to target, and it's requires a ton of information. So it shows Facebook's power in the amount of data that they have on each of our users, each of the users that they have. On the other side, the other thing that you're asking about is how it performs differently than, say, another social network like Twitter, is that Twitter, you don't have to have a real identity, first of all. And second of all, it's a public platform, as you just said. So you can try to reach anybody, you can try to follow anybody that is a user on Twitter. It's a great platform, especially for politicians and for just anyone who wants to have their opinions known. It's a little bit harder for advertisers to, because again, they don't have the real identity of individuals, and it's sometimes harder to sort of mine and get insights from the data that they have on users on Twitter. On Facebook, it's a closed network and it's very powerful in that social connections are the kind of connections that people value and trust. So one thing that I'd like to just leave away with the difference and the important difference between those kind of networks is that individuals tend to trust what other friends and family members say to each other. So that is presented on Facebook a huge challenge when it comes to misinformation. So when you are connected to people who might have, say, the same conspiracy theory or the same proclivity to believe that, say, COVID vaccines are dangerous flat out misinformation, right? But if you happen to be in a group of those same people and you're connected to them on Facebook, because these are closed groups, then that's the kind of recipe that really ripens that kind of misinformation and amplifies it easily. So that's the kind of difference. There's even more nuance, but that's the broad stroke difference between those platforms.
That's Cecilia Kong along with Shira Frankel. They are the author of An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. And Shira Frankel, this is an incredibly lucrative enterprise. And it's interesting. I know I did another one of the Facebook books several years ago, and the author of that book brought up the point that if Facebook simply charged, 99 cents a month for a subscription to Facebook, they now have something like 8.5 billion subscribers. That would be, roughly $8 billion a month of revenue. And the advertising model outpaces that by a lot. They can make more by mining this data. Their purpose is to keep you tuned in. They don't ever want you to close your Facebook app on your phone or on your computer. In 2018, you all report that Google and Facebook combined had ad revenue of $135 billion. When they keep you tuned in, how does that further and advance the business model of the advertising business model? Why is length of time on the site so important to them?
Well, length of time is advantageous to them in several ways. One in which, when they're selling ads to advertisers, it's helpful to say, not only do we have billions of people using our platform, but the average amount of time they spend on Facebook is X amount of minutes or X amount of hours. They call this metric sessions, and it's something that Facebook executives closely track. And as Cecilia noted, they gear their platform. They design Facebook to keep you logged on for as long as possible and logging in as many times a day as possible, because they want to be able to show advertisers those numbers. The second part of this is that when you are on Facebook, you are feeding them information about yourself. Everything you click on, every photograph you linger on for a few seconds longer than another, is a data point into who you are as a person. And so by connecting those data points, by seeing that I have lingered for a long time on photographs of beaches or islands, and that perhaps I've clicked on a link about sunscreen, they might know that I'm someone interested in going on a tropical beach vacation, and I would be primed for receiving advertisements on flights and hotel deals and sundresses and anything else a person might want for a beach vacation. It's such a great way to gather data on people that advertisers have flocked to them and made them, as you said, a prime place for people to buy ads. And one thing I would just note about the earlier suggestion that Facebook charge people 99 cents or 50 cents or whatever it is, Facebook executives have always been against that, because in order for them to work, in order for their business to become what it has become, which is the world's largest social media platform, they needed it to be free. A big part of the appeal, especially in other parts of the world, is how easily you can create a Facebook account and how easily it lets you connect with your friends and family and people in other parts of the world. They don't want to introduce any kind of friction to that, because the moment they do, the moment they have fewer people logging on, fewer people creating new accounts or perhaps not, deciding not to spend as much time there and maybe moving to a different free application, that's when they start to lose money. That's when their advertisers, their board, their shareholders start to think that they are maybe not this incredibly successful story that they have been telling the world.
And Cecilia, they even have the capacity to track users off site when they're not on Facebook. So they get all sorts of information, not just from what they're doing while they're on Facebook, but when they're other places. How does that work?
Yeah, they have different tools. One was known as Pixel, where they essentially drop cookies, but they're also able to match up. Basically, they're able to track when you are off Facebook, where other websites you go to. And they have other programs. They have numerous tools that match up information off of Facebook with information on Facebook related to each user. It's a powerful, powerful program that they have for data collection. And I will note that in April 2018, when Mark Zuckerberg was testifying in front of the Judiciary Committee on the Cambridge Analytica scandal, he was asked about tracking off of Facebook. And he was not entirely genuine when he said he needed to get back to the lawmakers who were asking about that because he needed more information. Because it's really well known, these programs in the advertising world that show that Facebook is able to, through cookies, as well as matching databases with other companies, how they're able to amass piles of information and data on users off of Facebook as well as on Facebook.
And Shira, we just have a couple of minutes before we have to take another quick break. But when it comes to the way they've organized things around private groups rather than public, a public model at, like in Twitter, you write that this has allowed these groups to, the fringe movements in particular, anti-vaxxers or militias, to organize and recruit volunteers. Why is that? Why is the privacy of the groups aiding and abetting these efforts to put together groups of fringe people?
Well, private groups, you know, Mark Zuckerberg himself describes it as a little bit of pushing people into private living rooms. And rather than thinking of Facebook as a big public square, you can go into a smaller room where people who are like-minded are going to be there and present with you. What people have found, what researchers and academics have found who have studied this, is that if you are drawn to extreme movements, what ends up happening is that you get pushed into ever more extreme groups. So if you were to join one group, which is known to sharing conspiracy theories, Facebook's algorithms would then suggest to you many other groups that are conspiracy theory minded. And so over the years of this going unchecked, people were joining more and more groups that suggested a number of conspiracies. I think QAnon was perhaps the most famous. Facebook has now taken steps to remove those groups and curb QAnon on the platform. But for years, QAnon groups were running rampant, and Facebook's own algorithms were suggesting that people join those groups.
You're listening to an archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're revisiting a conversation I had earlier this year with Cecilia Kang and Shira Frankel of the New York Times about their book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll listen to more of our conversation, and I'll ask Shira Frankel why Facebook is particularly ineffective in monitoring and stopping hate speech on its platform. A reminder that our conversation was pre-recorded, so we aren't taking any calls or comments today. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about Facebook, which is now called Meta. Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang are reporters for the New York Times. Their very powerful book is called An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. The social psychologist Shoshana Zuboff has asserted that, quote, Facebook's success depends upon one-way mirror operations engineered for our ignorance and wrapped in a fog of misdirection, euphemism, and mendacity. Facebook has gobbled up unparalleled amounts of data on people around the world and enjoined other companies to collect data on its behalf to sustain a profit center that in 2020 generated nearly $86 billion in revenue. In June of this year, its market value reached $1 trillion. Shira Frankel covers cybersecurity for the New York Times. She joined us on Zoom. A reminder, our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking any new calls or comments today. Shira, you write about the things that Facebook is fairly good at monitoring and identifying and the things that they're not. And you say that they're not particularly good at identifying hate speech, that they're better at things like violence or even terrorism or pornography. And you write that the same set of tools meant to stop a high school senior from bullying a freshman can't be used to stop people like monks in Myanmar from spreading malicious rumors about Rohingya Muslims. So is it the way they've got it set up to monitor groups on Facebook and posts on Facebook? Is it their approach to how they're doing it? Why are they ineffective when it comes to hate speech in particular?
Well, part of it is just scale. Facebook, we have to remember, they have tasked themselves by growing as large as they have tasked themselves with moderating content for billions of people. And the only way they can really do that at scale is through AI and through systems. Those systems have proven fairly good at things, as you said, like pornography or violence. But hate speech is incredibly culturally specific. It changes constantly. What constitutes hate speech changes constantly, even here in the United States, where, you know, you have to think the majority of Facebook executives and Facebook employees are going to be native English speakers. And if finding hate speech here in the United States is difficult for them and remains elusive for them, you can just imagine how difficult it is in a country like Myanmar, where over 100 different languages are spoken and where hate speech is constantly evolving about, you know, cultural moments and protests might ignite a new term for a specific group. And so to be on top of hate speech, you need to really be invested in the news and daily news reports from a place and in the culture of that place. It's not something that Facebook can easily do with AI systems. It's something that they have to do just by investing human beings with local knowledge. And at the scale Facebook is currently operating at, you have to imagine that they're going to be playing catch up with this for many, many years.
Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Usha, who's calling from Bel Air. Welcome to Midday with Sheriff Frankel.
Thank you. I wanted to know this. I haven't joined Facebook. And sometimes I'm linked to Facebook and I'm trying to read the content. Because I haven't joined Facebook, it'll disappear and it'll encourage me to join Facebook. Can people like me who haven't joined Facebook, who are sometimes there because they're linked and they're not able to read the entire content, then they're asked to join Facebook, can they be surveilled? Can they be followed with cookies, etc.?
It's a good question. We don't totally know the answer. Facebook does have cookies and trackers that follow you across the web. So when you're on other sites, it can see your unique IP address and where you're going across the web. But the amount of data they have on you if you are not a Facebook member is just a fraction of what they would have if you actually did join the company and sign up. And so I think that, yes, they have information. They have some amount of data that they keep on people that are not actual Facebook members. But it's not nearly the same amount of information as if you join the platform and begin engaging with it every single day as a member.
The book is called An Ugly Truth: Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. The authors are Shira Frankel, who joins us on our digital line, and Cecilia Kong. They are both reporters for the New York Times. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. And Shira, Facebook has set up an independent panel to decide some of these thorny issues about free expression. They did this in May of last year. What is that panel intended for? Who serves on it? And what's your take on whether or not it will be effective and whether or not it's a good response to the criticisms that Facebook has been under?
This panel that was set up by Facebook, it's known as the Facebook Oversight Board, was intended as a group of outside experts who could, in a sense, work as a Supreme Court would. They're going to make rulings on whether Facebook made the right decision or the wrong decision on specific things. Their most significant and important case they've had so far was the removal of Donald Trump's account. Facebook took that decision to them and asked, you know, in the wake of January 6th, we removed Donald Trump's account. Did we do the right thing? And their response to that was really interesting. They actually, what they did in effect was choose not to rule. They went back to Facebook and said, we don't have enough information. You as a company have not created enough rules or policies or explained your decision around Donald Trump's removal enough for us to tell you whether or not you did the right or wrong thing. And people saw that step by Facebook's oversight board as a move by them to say, well, we're not going to be a carte blanche. We're not going to make decisions for you. You can't just come to us when you've done something and ask us to create the policies for you. You need to start taking ownership and accountability and creating real policies that we can track and follow. And then we'll advise you on whether or not it was the right thing. And we're going, you know, it's left to be seen. This is a new program. It's certainly going to evolve. And I imagine right now Facebook is coming up with a response to that Trump decision and coming up with a policy around their decision to remove former President Donald Trump that the Oversight Board will then weigh and judge and decide whether or not it can be applied to many other leaders across the world who have taken Trump's way of doing business on Facebook, who have modeled themselves after Trump. And they'll have to decide whether those leaders should be removed as well.
And we have a email from a listener in Ellicott City, Maryland, named Laura, who says, I'm wondering what you think about the possibility that Mark Zuckerberg has what's called arrested emotional development. He was awfully young when he developed Facebook and it went global pretty fast. Did he grow emotionally as the company grew? And you mentioned towards the end of the book that there are some indications that he's even thinking about stepping away and concentrating more on what he calls the Zuckerberg-Chan initiative, the philanthropic foundation that he and his wife have set up. But it's a tough thing to ask you to psychoanalyze Mark Zuckerberg. But when it comes to emotional development, do you see and do the people you interview, you talked to 400 plus people to write this book. Did they talk about Zuckerberg's, evolution as a person, as he matured?
It's interesting. They talk about Mark Zuckerberg's evolution as an executive, as a business person, as a person who's interested in products. Very few people talk about his emotional evolution. I think that's partially because he doesn't show much of that publicly. We know that he's obviously shows a great deal of emotion towards a small group of friends that he's close with and to his immediate family. But it isn't something that he publicly shows. And so it's hard for anyone, including people who work with him daily, to comment on that. What I will say is that his interests, what motivates him, what drives him, that hasn't changed. He began the company as a person who was deeply interested in products and who really wanted to expand and grow as quickly as possible. And that remains his interest. Our book came out in July, and the first interview Mark Zuckerberg gave after our book came out was on the metaverse. It was on this idea that Facebook wants to be involved in every aspect of your life and this alternative reality that it could create for you. This isn't someone who has, in time, become reflective of the problems or who has shifted his attention to the problems that Facebook has introduced to society, despite, I think, Facebook PR people wanting to give that impression. What we see day to day by Mark Zuckerberg and from the people closest to him is that he remains a product person who wants to grow Facebook, who wants Facebook to continue to be on this innovative edge of new technology. And in that way, he very much remains who he was in his early days at Harvard.
Let's go to the phones to Abigail, who's on the line from Annapolis. Welcome to Midday with Shira Frenkel.
Hi, thank you so much. I just had a question about Instagram. So as a younger person around like 18, I don't really use Facebook, but I still don't really want my data being tracked. I do, however, use Instagram, and I know that Instagram is owned by Facebook. What are the similarities in data tracking between Facebook and Instagram just because of that connection?
The similarities in data tracking are basically that it's the same company and they are tracking you on Instagram in much the same way that they track people on Facebook. Instagram in some ways is even more data rich for them because you're uploading so many of your own images and videos, and that technology that they have to read people's faces, to see who you're posting with all the time, that gives them a tremendous amount of information. So imagine you and your friends are on Facebook and you don't even have to tag one each other in your stories or in your posts. They can use their technology to read those faces and say, oh, okay, well, these are the 10 people that this person spends the most time with. And these 10 people that this person spends the most time with frequent this and this location. Therefore, we know that they're interested in this kind of sport or this kind of food or that type of movie. And they can tell so much about you just by seeing who's in your extended social network and draw all sorts of conclusions about what you might buy and what they can advertise to you. And so, yes, I think that people sometimes think of Instagram as this very separate company. But for years now, its tracking of information, its data gathering has been very much in keeping with its parent company, with Facebook.
Yeah, and Facebook is the number one social media company in the world. Instagram is the number two. So, you know, they have incredible domination in the market. And Abigail brings up an interesting point. There's the impression, and you can tell us whether or not it's true or not, that Facebook users tend now to be older, that younger people are eschewing Facebook in favor of other social media platforms. Is this something that Facebook is worried about? And do you know of a particular, you know, concentrated effort to reverse that trend, to get younger people back on Facebook? Because certainly it started with younger people, college students in particular. What's your take on the demographic of who's using Facebook, of all their billions of users around the world?
Well, this is something that concerns Facebook and especially Mark Zuckerberg. He's very, very worried about the data, which is showing them that especially here in the United States and in much of the Western world, their audience is skewing, as you said, older and older. It is a much older population because teenagers are more and more drawn to new apps like TikTok or Instagram or Snapchat. I mean, there's a number of new and evolving apps that younger people think are more interesting and cooler than Facebook. I think primarily because they don't want to be on the same social media platform as their parents. It's just not fun and not cool. And so they're constantly looking to new technology. For a long time, Instagram was that technology for them. And I do think that for people in their 20s, Instagram is still very much a draw. But now you hear even teenagers saying they don't want to be on Instagram because it's not cool anymore. And so I do think that Facebook needs to constantly evolve, constantly push itself if it wants to capture that younger population.
And is Zuckerberg concerned particularly with Facebook? In other words, if somebody eschews Facebook but goes on Instagram or WhatsApp, he still owns both of those companies. Does he care which of those three they're on? Does it matter that they're not on Facebook, even though they're on something that he also owns?
Well, ideally, he wants you to be on everything. Ideally, he wants you as a customer to be using Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. I mean, if you're just using one of those, that's fine. They're probably happy with that as a company. But I think there's a reason why they recently rebranded Instagram as Instagram by Facebook. Now, people who work at Instagram, and I think the founders of Instagram, were very upset by that because they have always imagined Instagram as its own product, its own company with a different ethos. But he's reminded people over and over again that Instagram is part of Facebook. They've recently merged the messaging across those different apps so that if you are a user of one platform like Facebook, you can message somebody on Instagram. They're trying to link them more and more so that, you know, their users feel like, well, I might as well just download this other app too, because it's already going to cross-post. If I upload a photograph to Facebook, it's going to automatically suggest to me to just share it on Instagram as well. And why not just click that other button and say, fine, share it on both apps? Of course, that's what Facebook wants you to do, because it's great for them as a company to show activity across multiple apps. But it also means that you're exposing a lot more of your data and a lot more information about yourself. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see whether in the next few years Facebook continues to merge these apps with one another and push people onto all three of them, and whether that does cost them more young users.
In our last 30 seconds, how do you escape the reach of the tracking that Facebook has on you? If you delete your account, can you also remove the data that they have about you already?
You can request to delete the account, and it's a big question whether or not you can really delete all the data. I think that even if you were to do all that, even if you're no longer a Facebook member, they're still tracking you to some effect across the web. And so I just think that by mere virtue of using the internet today, you're allowing companies like Facebook, and I should add Google and Amazon and all these big tech companies, to track you. I think the bigger question is how we regulate some of that behavior by the tech companies and how we responsibly use the internet despite all of that tracking and monitoring.
Shira Frankel with Cecilia Kong. She is the author of An Ugly Truth: Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. We spoke in September. That's it for us today. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Mallory Pinkard-Pierre is our supervising producer. Rob Sivek is our senior producer. Jemila Kremple is WIPR's digital content director. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. You can hear Midday on the radio or on demand. Download the WIPR app wherever you get your apps and subscribe to our podcast, or check us out on the Midday webpage at WIPR.org. You can follow our show at Midday WIPR, and you can follow me at Tom Hall WIPR. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.